the committee to order. And we're going to massage the agenda just a little bit, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 738. And then we're going to take up Senate Bill 746. And I'll call Ron Dexter.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Dexter. I'm a consultant at this point for Career and Technical Education, formerly Associate Superintendent for the Office of Professional Technical Education at the Oregon Department of Education, and my past includes being the Director at the Save and Skill Center in North Clackamas School District and a number of other administrative and teaching positions. I retired from the department about a year ago, and I had written a couple bills for professional technical education to help other regions in Oregon jumpstart professional technical education programs like the Save and Skill Center. And we saw some success at that. Medford region tried to pass a bond to build a regional center, and it narrowly was defeated. In the Gresham area, the Center for Advanced Learning is completed and will open this fall, and so that will be one of the first regional skill centers that's similar to Saban, but in a little bit different model. And so, after I left the department, I decided I would write some legislation to help current technical education. I saw the funding crisis that was coming, and I was very concerned about the quality of professional technical programs, because there is an additional cost for equipment and supplies, and because in selective program I was concerned that along with music and art and choir and drama and so forth, professional technical programs would be put on the chopping block. And I watched what happened with the Quality Ed Commission, and really some great work was done with the Quality Ed Commission, but I don't think a lot of attention was paid to career and technical education in that study. And so basically what I did is I used the model of the Quality Ed Commission to say, let's continue to study how community colleges and higher education and K-12 can work more closely together, and let's appoint a commission to look at issues like how can we work smarter, more closely together, and leverage our resources with business and industry. And so basically this bill does not request any money. It simply requests the appointment of a committee appointed by the governor's office, the superintendent of public instruction, and the Department of Community College Workforce Development Commissioner, to appoint a commission that would complete the study and report back to the next legislature in 2005.
Thank you, Ron. Is there questions? Senator Ferriero?
Mr. Chairman, I really feel strongly about this bill. The technical education is something that's sort of been withering in our education system for a while. In many areas besides high technology, every school used to have wood shop, every school used to have automotives, many schools had vo-ag programs, and I think there's only just a few left of the vo-ag programs. And I'm not suggesting we go back to the days where kids learned how to hammer horseshoes, but professional technical education is a real key component in a career ladder for people, and not everybody's a matriculant. They don't just go automatically to higher education. We need to have some alternatives, some technical education alternatives. And I think it's a way to keep people engaged. It's a way to offer them some value-added educational opportunities. And in a sense, it's a way to loop them back into higher education. And a lot of folks go for vocational technical training and then end up finding their career niche and then investing more in their higher education. But it's just another rung on the career ladder, and I just really believe that we ought to have study done that identifies the opportunities, connects the benefits, connects the dots for people, demonstrates the value-added potential for VOAG or technical education. So this, to me, seems like exactly the right thing to do. So I'm hoping we can support it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Marcet.
Ron.
Yes.
As you know, I've been a long supporter of the program, State Skills Center. I've visited it twice. We've talked.
Right.
And I did serve on an interim committee as a representative at one point. What's the difference between that committee and this committee, or are they the same? That was a. I don't know if that would. Could you describe the other committee that I was on?
Let's see. Senator Marcet, Chairman Starr. I'm not familiar with the work of the.
It was a
committee you're referring
committee
to.
Between the 99 and 01 session. We met with a number of school people as well as representatives from the private sector. I know there was someone from Boeing there, someone from Intel, and the gist of that program was to, that work group was to promote, and it did recommend money for similar programs, including one in Lane County that I think Lane Community College would be involved in. I think that year Sabin, the next year, was given some money, but the rest of the program wasn't funded. I'm very supportive of continuing the study. I think it is it's more than just a woodshop.
Right.
Vocational tax program. It's a very high-level program with equipment donated by the private sector, instructors coming from the private sector, and so I'm very supportive.
Yeah. Let me say, Senator Moore said, I think the work that was the result of some of that work probably had something to do with the Center for Advanced Learning, because Somazio from Boeing was the educational affairs manager in that region. And so I'm not quite sure if that work ended up being helping the Center for Advanced Learning get off the ground. But my...
That's the program at Gresham.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great program, and I support it.
Great. Thank you. Let me just say I appreciate both of your remarks, and I think there's a lot of myths about professional technical education. One is, and I'd hope that this study would help dispel some of these myths. One of the myths is that professional technical education is for kids that are not going on to college. That is a myth. When I was at Sabin, we surveyed kids a year out and found that 70% went on to post-secondary education. And one-third of those went to four-year universities. So, as you say, professional technical education today is not what it was when we were in school. It's much more high-tech, it's very rigorous, and it's a career pathway to a multitude of careers, including when I was at Sabin, we had students entering MIT and the very finest universities across the United States, including our community college system, which was just absolutely excellent for them, in which they earned dual credit. So we've got, Oregon has a lot of good things going, but we could do some better things, especially working together with higher ed and community colleges in K-12. There's some areas, like for example in distance learning and so forth, that we could do more to leverage the $50 million that was spent on technology in K-12. We could do more with those resources to build on that investment and not look so much at our own turf, whether it be just because K-12 is funded separately from community colleges and higher ed is funded separately, to some degree that funding system creates a disconnect. And there's many good attempts to work closely together, but I think this commission could help us work more closely together to create some quality programs for kids. And I think in terms of it would definitely help Oregon's economy. Some people don't understand, I think this is another myth, that current technical education is the very beginning of the workforce that is to happen in the future in Oregon. And for some reason, people a lot of times don't include the high school school or middle school is part of that. And that's where it all starts. It's helping kids get a sense of direction and hope for a future and to get started building their skill level, both academic and technical, while they're in high school and middle school. And so those are some myths that I would hope this commission would provide some visibility to help people understand what current technical education really is all about.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Let's talk about the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, because I noticed on the back of the page 2, line 25, will not, okay, members of the task force are not entitled to compensation or reimbursement for their expenses. So this has absolutely no fiscal impact. Is that what you're saying?
No.
What?
Read the next line.
Oh, the next line. The Department of Education shall provide staff support. Well, as funds are available, right?
No.
No. That's what you should include in that.
Thank you. Ron, this is...
Thank you.
I appreciate this. This is a very well-thought-out proposal. You've listed many duties of the task force. I think they're well thought out, and I for one, am supportive of seeing this happen. And I thank you for bringing the bill to us.
Thank you. I might close by saying, not being at the department, I've had limited access to people around the state of Oregon, but I have sent it to one community college president. I've sent it to the OEA. They made a suggestion, and I've revised the draft based on their suggestion. I've talked to the Department of Education about this, and so I've kind of done in principles. I've circulated it. It's being discussed at the regional coordinators meeting next week, so there would be additional letters of support and so forth that come.
May I just take a quick minute? Ron, I guess what I'm getting at is if you could work it out with the department to be a pass-through for monies that would come in to help do the program, and if that's stated explicitly in the bill that it will be funded on a funds available basis, that would get it out of Ways and Means. Otherwise,
I see.
It just may not go anywhere but to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something you might think about.
Any other questions?
No further questions. Anyone else want to testify on the bill? No one else testifying today on Senate Bill 738. Chair would entertain a motion to...
It's only a public hearing today.
Yeah, it's only a public hearing.
That works for me.
Okay.
We're going to have no further public hearing on Senate Bill 738 today. We'll close that public hearing, open public hearing on Senate Bill 746, and that also is public hearing. Is that right?
Yes, they're all public hearing today.
All public hearings only today. Right.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, some people have asked me since I retired, how come I'm not fishing and how come I'm writing bills? The reason is I care a lot about these issues, and I understand what needs to be done in the state of Oregon, and I'm hoping legislatively these commissions would jumpstart some good things that would happen for kids. The second bill that I've authored is more narrow in focus. It focuses on public safety, which is just one of 22 different career endorsement areas in professional technical education. When I was the director at the Save and Skill Center, we founded a program called Criminal Justice, and it linked real closely with the Criminal Justice program at the community college in a 2+2 format. And I have today with me the instructor of the Criminal Justice program at Saban, and I'll invite him up here in just a minute. But what I wanted the committee to understand the purpose of this legislation. To my knowledge, there are very few criminal justice programs at the high school level in Oregon. And let me just share some data with you. that is about a year old, but it shares with it demonstrates how many high school students are enrolled in professional technical programs in the state. There's about 70,000 high school students enrolled in professional technical programs. In arts and communication, this is data from a couple years ago, but 6,600 students are enrolled in arts and communication programs. About 37,000 are enrolled in business management. There are 7,700 enrolled in human resources, and that's where public safety would fall. And primarily, most of those programs those students in that human resources are going to be in child services, early childhood education programs in human resources, and perhaps also other related programs, but not public safety so much. Health services, there's 6,300, industrial engineering, 24,800, and natural resources, about 9,000. And I was so impressed with the interest and the quality of the program at Saban. Our governor has seen that program. I think Senator Morris had seen it. I think Senator Starr, you saw it when you were there. And we had 180 high school students sign up for that program, and they didn't even know who the instructors were going to be. And that was about 8 years ago. There's and Bill will testify today currently about how many kids are in the program. But I saw such a wonderful transformation in these students in the criminal justice program, and I think that there are several things in the forefront that cause a need for these more of these programs. The Homeland Security bill is one example. I think that this is an opportunity for Oregon to bring in some additional resources for programs like this if we were to get this going. There's simply a lot of interest in public safety with high school students, and yet there are very few opportunities for them to get enrolled in any kind of a program. Most people don't even know that the program at Saban exists. We had to write our own curriculum and create it out of nothing. We could not borrow that from one other high school in Oregon. And I feel so strongly that that could be an Oregon, that could be a national model for public safety at the high school level. It's taught by law enforcement instructors that have experience in the field. And with that, let me invite Bill Cross up to say a few words about the program.
Thank you.
Chairman Stark and members of the committee. My name is Bill Cross, and I have the past 8 years been an instructor in criminal justice at the Saban Skills Center. And prior to that, I was a police officer for 22 years, and I'm currently a background investigator also for the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department. I've kept my kind of foot in the door a couple different ways, which I'll probably explain here in a few seconds. With our program, our numbers have held pretty steadily. We only have two instructors, so we're kind of limited to how many we can have per class. First year, we had a lot of kids who I think they thought was going to be cops and robbers and fun and games. And if they found out what goes into law enforcement and the type of knowledge and skill levels and decision making and things that go into it, people are now coming in with the interest that this is what they want to do. And so the benefit there has been that we, and then with the, for 9/11 a year ago, there's actually spurred more interest, and we have more students than really what we can even take on. The benefit, I guess, I see of having a criminal justice or public safety program is when I was a police officer, I usually had contact with a young person because I was arresting them or their parents called because they were out of control, and you didn't really get a chance to see the kids, the majority of the kids. And same thing with the students. Normally, most police officers don't stop you to tell you what a careful driver you are and how well you're doing because there's no probable cause for that, and actually you're violating their rights. So, again, usually the contacts are negative. And with the program we've found that the students get a chance because not only do the instructors law enforcement, but we have found that the community has supported this. Clackamas County Sheriff's Department, Lake Oswego Police Department, Oregon City, Gladstone, because we are a regional facility. facility at this point, all allow officers and their reserves and regulars to come in and work with the students. And the first time, for example, we had a deputy sheriff from the SWAT team came in to work with us on building searches, and he said, and I said, he said, how much do you need? I said, well, you know, 3 days would be really great. He said, well, how about 1 day? I said, fine. He met with the kids. They worked 3 days, and into that he handed me his card, said, next time, just call me directly. They're great kids. And so there's been a, I think, and that's the reason the chiefs and the sheriff have also seen a benefit in this, is the chance for students and law enforcement to see each other in a positive light. Since we started the program, I now have a number of students in 4-year and 2-year programs in college, also military, and I now have 8 students who are now working officers in the state of Oregon. I know all the kids in class are not going to go on to law enforcement necessarily, but there are going to be a number of new things created here shortly with the Homeland Security. I think there's going to be things we don't even aware of yet. The other thing is, I feel with it, is that kids benefit from, if nothing else, they're going to be better citizens. They know why police do what they do, how they do what they do. They're going to be good witnesses. I think they'll be much better citizens in the community, understanding like rights and laws and things of that nature. We have an articulation group at the community college. The first-year students get credited if they get an A or B from our course. It's taking introduction to law enforcement. And for the second year, if they get an A or B out of the course, they're credited with taking patrol procedures. Those are two required courses. Our instructors required to have the same qualifications and credits that community college instructors do, so they're weighted out with the same credit. And so if they go to Clackamas, for example, at community college, they would get 2 required courses out of the way, but they also carry 111, 112 numbers, which make them 4-year transferables. The kids already have a head start and quite a savings. The community college with an articulation agreement, the kids get that for $40, and that's pretty cheap in this day and age of community of grades. So the kids get a good start on under their higher education as well. So those are the benefits I see, and the growth that I've seen happen within our program.
Thank you. Question, Bill.
Thank you. Have you had a discussion with the Department of Education for these two bills?
Senator Morissette, Chairman Starr, yes, I have.
And what response did they give you in terms of staffing?
I haven't really discussed that in any kind of a detail, but the expectation is that a lot of this would be volunteer work by business people from business and industry and staff, existing staff from both DCCWD and OD and OPTE. So we're not anticipating.
Well, the department itself, though. I mean, they're going to put department staff time into this. Is that so? There is a fiscal.
There's an expectation. I shouldn't say there's Senator Morissette. There's more than an expectation. It's clearly spelled out in the membership that the Department of Education would be involved in the.
Now, how do they feel about that? Have they told you that they can absorb that cost?
Yeah, I really can't speak for the Department of Education anymore. Yeah.
Well, okay, let me approach it from another area, because I have 3 bills, 4 bills that I'm struggling with in terms of cost. And one of them was with the Department of Education, 2 of them with the Department of Education. And so what I am working on is a funds available basis on in some ways. And that involves language in the bill that the treasurer will, if you collect any funds, that it will be put into, the treasurer will put it into an account that will go to the department. And let me just tell you briefly about a bill that the Attorney General's office took after the last session, which was a hotline for student violence. There was no fiscal impact because the Attorney General said he would absorb the cost. Well, he didn't have the money to absorb the cost, but Senator Wyden received a $150,000 grant about 6 weeks ago, which now funds that program. So the authorization was given for this program to move forward with funds available, and it went through this pipeline that was set up. And I guess what I would suggest that you look at is if there's Homeland Security money, if there's some source of funds that might come into the program at some point, that the department might be you know, that there, the mechanism be put into the bill that would allow that money to move into the department to do that. And I'm suggesting this because, first of all, Ways and Means, you know, any fiscal impact goes to Ways and Means, and there's no guarantee that anything will ever come out of Ways and Means, given our budget constraints, and besides the unfunded mandate issue that is alive and well.
Yeah, Senator Morissette, my expectation when I wrote both of these bills, my expectation is that there would be no fiscal impact. That, for example, on this bill, the specialist responsible for human resources would be the lead in assisting the commission, but it would not be a major responsibility of that person, and there may be some sectorial assistance, that kind of setting up meetings and so forth, but that also could fall to someone from business and industry. It could be shared. I don't see it. It was never ever written with the intent that this would be a total Department of Education responsibility. It's a shared responsibility. In fact, it really won't work. It won't work if it's totally the departments of responsibility, because the concept here is to have it driven by all of the partners.
Well, bring a note from your mother, and,
yeah,
and we'll see what happens. No, really, I think it's great. I totally support it, and I would really like to see it move along. And so I'm just
great.
Trying to help and talk to the department. And
yeah, I think the one question you've raised is a good one, and I need some counsel on that, is if there are grant funds that become available, then does that need to be included in the legislation that they would be funneled through the Department of Education?
The language, the standard language is says that a and involves a treasurer's office receiving the funds and then passing it on to the department that will
right.
administer the funds.
Yeah.
And so there is some standard language that is becoming very popular these days for some of these programs.
I thank you again, and it's real important, I think, that we continue to pursue this. Funding is in crisis, and we know that. But I think the future of these programs is very important to our state. And so we bring this back for a work session. Hope that you might have had some meetings and I'll have our staff administrator talk to you and see if we can bring this back in a form that can get some action.
Great.
Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we're rolling right along in the as a subcommittee of the Education Committee, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 727, which is my bill, and the The 727 is a bill that has far-reaching ramifications, as many of you know. If you've been around here for the last 10 years, you know that some or all of these issues addressed in the bill have been introduced by me previously, or supported by me. Reading the what the measure does, I think it's very clear that some of this fits in with what is mandated by No Child Left Behind. Some of it is a part of what was proposed 2 years ago when I proposed that we offer English immersion and abolish keeping our children in ESL programs for several years. The measure would abolish certificates of initial and advanced mastery. directs the governor to establish an advisory committee on education and technology. Some of these things are, of course, are happening because of the advances in technology. We're seeing local school districts offering courses by technology, community colleges and universities also advancing along those lines, offering distance learning, 724 to students all over the state. Creates a high technology grant program to fund computer and technology for schools. Requires school districts to provide professional development, technology skills and training. Specifies professional development requirements. Directs Oregon Department of Education to require all public school students in grades K-8 to demonstrate specified competencies in technology use. Requires career and educational counseling of students. Requires ODE to develop educational program for spreadsheet and computer software use in advanced presentations. The bill further requires students to be held back if student fails to meet grade level standards. We discussed the bill last week that would have done the same thing. Requires school district to adopt policies that require students to correct errors that student makes on papers and tests. Isn't that interesting? And teach them something. Requires all graded papers of students be kept in a binder for the school year. Requires school districts to advance students to the next grade level. If the student has demonstrated on assessment, the student has met the requirements of the course. Requires school districts to allow student mentors, appropriates dollars, and declares an emergency. Very ambitious bill. I had not expected to bring this to a public hearing, and I'm thinking that it would be appropriate that we just drop the idea. If we have no objections from the two witnesses who signed up to testify, we will remove it from today's agenda and leave it go to wherever he goes from here. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 727 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 389. Senate Bill 389 is also a bill that I introduced at the request of an individual who tried unsuccessfully to have their child met by a bus at a different location within the Lake Oswego School District, where they were required to have their child stand and wait for the bus in front of or next to a sexual predator's residence. And what the bill does would be to require that schools make other arrangements for picking up children other than in front of the home of a predatory sex offender, and it specifies 1,000 feet. I believe that something less than 1,000 feet would be adequate, but I think that to require a child to stand in front of a home of a sexual predator to be picked up by a bus is inappropriate. And so with that, I invite Patty O'Sullivan and John Marshall to come forward.
Good Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Senator, I first want to thank you for your prior disposition of your other bill. And for the record, I'm Patty O'Sullivan, Portland Public School District. And I applaud your effort to bring this forward. I, too, do not believe a child should stand in front of a sexual predator's home to be required to stand there to be picked up by a bus. However, the bill as it's written does cause us some concern. And let me go over there's actually four areas of concern at this point, and then I'll offer you a possible other way that we could take care of this. First of all, identification. Sex offenders, I believe, are obligated to register with the county or the city, and they have probation officers and parole officers, and there's a system for that, but there's no current system to link that information up with a school district. We have no idea where sex offenders are located unless we just happen to know from some publicity that happens to be around. They tend to move around a lot, and my understanding is they have 10 days to actually register, so the safety factor really isn't taken care of. By the time paperwork goes back and forth, the 10 days, it could be a month before anything happens. Secondly, liability. If we didn't get the information soon enough, or we didn't get it at all, or it was mistaken information, it would really leave a lot of people open to a lot of liability if something happened. We'd be concerned about that. Third is funding. It would take an extensive record-keeping system, both by public safety. I'm kind of surprised they're not here to say that. But also school districts. We would have to notify all the parents at that bus stop. We have 85 languages spoken in our school, so we'd have to get them translated and contact the parents. And that would be kind of a record-keeping nightmare. Not insurmountable, but because we do it all the time. But the most important piece of this really is the safety for the kids. While the bill is very important and laudable, it actually could set up worse safety situations for children. And let me go over a couple of those. For one thing, we have numerous special ed kids who are either physically unable or emotionally unable to be picked up anywhere but at their door. Their door may be very close to someone else's door. They're picked up right there at the street. And many of them are immobile in wheelchairs or emotionally are not prepared to move out of what they do every single day the same way. That's an issue. Little children having to walk further from their homes, possibly across busy streets if there isn't a decent bus stop or available without going across a street for 1,000 feet or even 500 feet. You're talking about kindergartners, first graders, second graders. Changing stops in some neighborhoods that might be very frequent with sex offenders moving in and out, and the little kids will get confused about what stop they were supposed to go to. We may end up with lost children. This happens right now, much less if we change their stop all the time. They may actually have to walk by a sex offender's house to get to their new bus stop and would actually be safer closer to their homes. For instance, if they lived in a cul-de-sac and the sex offender lived at the end, how do they get out of the cul-de-sac except walk past the sex offender's house? And also, just for our school district, we give metro passes to junior high and high school children who take city buses and the MACs and the streetcar to school. And, of course, that would be impossible to change those for this bill. But we have a solution, or just a possible solution. First of all, we would obviously, and most elementary schools do, continue educating children about the stranger danger kinds of things, and that's very important to continue that. But the other thing that we were thinking is that we should be putting the onus on the sex offender. So right now, in current law, there's places they can't live, there's places that they can't frequent, like playgrounds, like schools, things like that. So if you were really serious about doing this, I would like to see the hardship and the onus put on them, not on a school district and a family and kids. And so to switch the responsibility. And that's it. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
The situation that was brought to me was that the district, or the child, the parents of the child, having knowledge of the sexual predator, predatory sex offenders residence, brought this to the attention of the school district and said, we don't want our child picked up in front of this house because of who's living there. Now, if that kind of notification came to the district, is there any way of developing amendment to this bill that would allow the district to pick up the child at a different spot along the route there? Seems to me that this is the thing that and the reason for the bill being here, and I'm not thinking about a horrendous record-keeping opportunity for districts or for police, but if a neighborhood or a parent knows of this predatory sex offender living here in the neighborhood and brings it to the district's attention, couldn't we make it possible for that child to be picked up around the corner or some place agreeable to the district and to the child that's not in front of the home of the... This is, looks like it would be something we should be able to work out.
Chair Starr, I can only answer for my district, and then perhaps John has some information that he can add. But I guess I would be surprised if that was a situation that a school district wouldn't do something. I don't know why they didn't do something, because I don't know the details of the story, how many other kids were there. If there were 20 other kids there every day, is that really dangerous to the... I don't know any of the details, so I really can't answer that with any detail.
May I?
Senator Marshall.
This is a pretty permissive piece of legislation to the extent practicable, and if the district would say, hey, this is not a practical thing for us to do, they wouldn't have to do it. I mean, it seems to me that what this bill does is send a notice out to districts that they, and if they are asked that there is some statutory language that urges them to do this, if it's practical. I mean, I don't see it as a mandate. That's my reading of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I join Ms. O'Sullivan in expressing some concerns. I guess one of the points that I was going to make is I was not aware of any circumstance where this was a problem. Apparently, Mr. Chairman, there is one, and I'd like to talk to that school district and figure out exactly, get some more details on the issue, and if a request was made, then why a change was not made. But what I wanted to point out is the concern that while Ms. O'Sullivan, I think, represents very well the interests of not only the Portland School District, but urban school districts in a lot of small communities. There may not be within that community a bus stop within 1,000 feet of the home of or the residence of some of these criminals. So I think it's possible to create quite a burden. And I agree with Ms. O'Sullivan as well that the burden ought to be placed on these criminals, not on the school district. Bus routes are very finely tuned to maximize resources to make sure that buses don't go too far empty, and so just changing a bus stop is not as easy as just deciding one day to do it and it's changed the next. So I'd like to explore the details of the Lake Oswego situation, find out what happened there, and maybe we can come up with a remedy. I agree that the bill is relatively permissive because it does say to the extent practicable, but I'm concerned that if this particular language were in statute, then it would create some liability issues if school districts did not take action within a specific period of time or as rapid enough as somebody thought. But I admit it's an issue, and I'd like to explore and find out if there's not a way that we can deal with this.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
I certainly understand the reason that the bill is before the committee. Is there a possibility that even though there is a permissive nature of this bill, that it could create a liability for school districts to do the analysis and for one reason or another decide that changing the bus stop is impractical and then something occurs that's untoward? In other words, what we're creating here is the expectation that in every case the school district will analyze the situation. If there is a bus stop closer than 1,000 feet to a registered sex offender's home, they change the bus stop, which creates an expectation. And it creates the impression that there will be absolute protection for those kids. And if that doesn't occur for one reason or another, how would that be documented and where would that record be kept? And if something does occur with that registered predatory sex offender and a school child, what liability does the district then have for not making the change?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, that's the exact issue that I was trying to get to relative to the liability issues, and I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure there would be, if something were to happen, I'm sure some enterprising trial lawyer would not very quickly come to the aid of whomever and create a plaintiff situation and go after the school district.
And Chair Starr, Senator Farioli, prior to you coming in, one of my two beginning points was, one of them was just that, the liability. But the point before that I made was because we don't have notification of where sex offenders live at this time, it would take a whole new record-keeping system between law enforcement, parole, probation, and school districts to exchange information. And so until we got that information, we wouldn't know where they were anyway. And so then you set up the whole liability thing. And so if practicable, might sound permissive, but I agree with Mr. Marshall that once it's in law, the if practicable, it doesn't mean anything to people when something happens to their, you know, out in the community. So I agree that I think we should, you know, that John can look into that one situation, see what happened, because we don't really know. And I can't believe that a school district being notified of something like that wouldn't look into it and wouldn't have a very good reason for not moving that school stop, but I don't know.
Well, man, yes. Okay, I guess always the worst case scenario. Now, I have a question, and it has to do with the bullying bill that was passed last session, because parents were concerned with bullying and harassment, intimidations, and principals said, "Well, I can't do anything because I don't have the authority." Okay, they have the authority. Isn't there liability if a principal doesn't use his authority and may not even be aware that somebody is being bullied, but some enterprising lawyer says, "Aha, this has been going on. The principal hasn't done anything. He's supposed to do anything, so I'm going to go to court." I mean, isn't this part of the liability?
Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, you're right. We have liability. We get sued all the time for lots of things that seem out of our control sometimes. But it takes a lot of resources to defend those. But as far as the bullying, it really depends on what the district has done with that bill. I can only speak again for my district. We revised our entire policy based on an internal committee of prevention people, then joined by external folks, and we revised our whole policy, got it out to every school, and educated the principals on the new policy and the ramifications of not reporting and not doing something about that. But again, that's my district, and I'm assuming that every district has done something like that. So you do the best, do it to the best of your ability, and that's why we don't want something like this in statute, because then we have to move forward on an unfunded mandate.
I guess I don't know if it's a question or a statement, but the one thing missing here is that, well, I guess the district is supposed to take the initiative, and in your case, a parent took the initiative and the district responded, which is different than the district shall, to the extent I've established a route. So the district is supposed to know this, And what you're saying is that the district has no way necessarily of knowing that a sexual predator just moved into the neighborhood. So I could see that as a problem. And I guess if the bill said that the district would respond to a parental complaint to the extent practicable to do something, I don't know if it needs a statute or not, but I can see where the district wouldn't be in a position of knowing necessarily that a sexual predator moved in. So I think you're half right.
Senator Perioli?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a prohibition? I believe there is a prohibition to prevent a predatory sex offender from living within 1,000 feet of a school district or a school building.
Chair Starr, Senator Ferriello, we covered this too. I believe that there is.
Answer that.
Our point was that the onus should be on the sex offender and the criminal justice system to say where they can live. You're right, there already are some prohibitions about where they can live, where they can frequent, that they can't come in contact with children. And my suggestion was, or recommendation was, to add this to the list and switch the responsibility to the sex offender and the criminal justice system, not the schools and the children and their families. That you're, in essence, sort of putting the responsibility on the wrong folks for this particular issue.
No further questions, Mr.
Chairman. You essentially saying that in that regard, then the sex offender has to move away from the bus stop.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Might work. I thank you very much, and I would like to have a report. Mr. Marshall, please, sir.
And, Mr. Chairman, did you have any correspondence relating to this issue?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
I'll check with your office. Thank you.
You bet. With that, we're going to close the public hearing. Senate Bill 389 and adjourn Senate Education Committee for the day, and I thank you.